Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I don't know, after Wesley and Clinton sort of blast me out of here, I feel like I need to go take a nap. I'm so exhausted listening to the rant at the end. I feel like I need to go close my eyes and wave a fan over myself to calm down. I'm not sure I have any energy left to do anything else, but thank you for those of you who do have some energy left to take on the wake-up call, because today's topic is going to be one of those things where you are both a little shocked at what you hear, maybe a little embarrassed at what you hear, and possibly, I don't know, I was going to use the word taunted. That may not be the word, but challenged may be the better word. Challenged to do something about it. Ridge Schuyler here with us today from the Charlottesville Works Initiative. We're going to be talking about poverty. Poverty and chronic unemployment and some of the numbers. We're not going to overdo it with statistics, but some of the news that you're going to find out during this hour from Ridge is surprising. So, Ridge Schuyler from the Charlottesville Works Initiative. Good morning, Ridge.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, I always thank people for taking their time on a Sunday, especially it's a nice Sunday. It's not that cold out there. It's sunny.
January 10th, and it's 52 degrees and sunny.
Fine with me. You know, I'm a person who likes all four seasons, but for some reason this year, you know, I live in this log cabin with a really crummy driveway when the snow comes, and so far right now I've been like, good, no snow, I'm fine with that. But today is the day that we're going to talk about poverty, chronic unemployment, and a project that you did several years ago, the Orange Dot Project, that if my reading skills worked properly, or what led to the Charlottesville Works Initiative and has led to Orange Dot Project 2.0,
I guess. That is correct.
So the Orange Dot Project, give me two or three sentences of that, about that, and what led to and has become the mission of the Charlottesville Works Initiative.
Well, in two or three sentences, when I was the district director for Congressman Tom Perriello, our office was located on Garrett Street, and people would just walk across from Friendship Court or South 6th Street, some of our supported housing in Charlottesville, and say, excuse the expression on a Sunday, but I just want a damn job. And as I traveled with the congressman down to Martinsville and Danville, where there weren't any jobs, I could understand that sentiment down there. But I could not understand how people in Charlottesville could not find meaningful work. And so when Tom and I were let go by the people of the 5th Congressional District, I set about trying to figure out what's the situation in Charlottesville, how many people need to find those jobs, and why are we having such a tough time doing it? And that led to the Orange Dot Project.
The Orange Dot Project really identified the number of people, the large number of people, a few statistics, and I've got some in my paper, and we'll continue to hit and miss on them throughout the hour, talking about poverty and chronic unemployment. But for those of us, especially at WPVC, this is the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Everyone listening should care about what we're talking about, should not be sort of waving their hand off at this being not a problem and sort of self-causing. What did you find out when doing the Orange Dot?
So the Orange Dot Project report, the initial report came out in 2011. And what we found was that 29% of Charlottesville's families did not earn enough to be self-sufficient. And I was dumbstruck, frankly, and it's not easy to make me stop talking. So being dumbstruck was something amazing in my world. But to find that that number, that percentage of our families in Charlottesville did not earn enough to be self-sufficient was shocking. And, you know, I decided to look at not some kind of abstract notion like a federal poverty level, but I looked at what does it actually cost to live in our actual town? What does rent cost? What does food cost in Charlottesville? And using those numbers is what I came up with. This is what a person needs to earn in order to make ends meet in Charlottesville, and 29% of our families back then did not earn that.
I find that to be, I mean, it's shocking. And when you give that number, are you talking about someone who can't pay their bills during that month? Are you talking about someone who can't pay their bills that month if some unexpected bill comes up, if the car breaks down, or somebody who can't live in their own separate home, must live with their brother and sister because they can't afford their own apartment, must live on some sort of subsidy from the city or the county? Or are we talking about somebody who's living paycheck to paycheck but can pay their bills as long as the car doesn't break down?
No, we're talking about people who do not earn enough to pay for their basic needs of food, shelter, and clothing and utilities without some assistance. It could be assistance from a family member. It could be assistance from the government. But just to put a very fine point on it, if you look at the cost of rent for a two-bedroom apartment in Charlottesville, and, when I talk, I focus on families, which is, sadly, it turns out that it's a mom with a couple of kids that really is the family that is struggling in Charlottesville. Well, if that mom is working full-time, 40 hours a week at a minimum wage job, she earns $14,400 a year. If you look at the cost of a two-bedroom apartment in Charlottesville, the average cost of a two-bedroom apartment is $927 a month, which is roughly $12,000 a year. So she earns $14,400. She would have to pay $12,000 in rent if she was paying market rates. That leaves, $2,000 a year to pay for everything else: food, utilities, and clothing. Well, we all know that's not possible.
So, and if she's got two kids, that doesn't include child care.
That does not include child care. So child care and transportation, those are expenses that you need to shell out in order to work. This doesn't count that. This is just what it takes for food, shelter, clothing, and utilities. It is just not possible to survive in Charlottesville on your own and work in a minimum wage job full time.
Here we are on the Sunday morning wake-up call, 94.7 WPVC, talking with Ridge Schuyler. He's the, what is your official title at
CWI? The director of the Charlottesville Works
Initiative. Now, did you start the Charlottesville Works Initiative yourself?
I did.
So you made it, so you're not only the director, you're the creator?
I'm the founder, the invoicer, the chief bottle washer, yes.
Does that make you an entrepreneur?
It does. Which is a very, very interesting turn of events for me at my age to start something from scratch. But it has been fascinating.
All right. So there's lots to get into here, both the statistics and numbers, how CWI, the Charlottesville Works Initiative, works, and how the system is set up. But one of the basic questions that comes up when I'm doing my homework for the show is the goal, or one of the major goals, is that everyone looking to work needs to have the income to support their family without subsidy, correct?
That's the goal.
Are there that many jobs in our modern society?
Our evidence indicates that there are. And put a fine point on that, the Department of Labor, provides market information, and we pulled a report that showed that there are actually 29,000 jobs in the Charlottesville region. These are not openings, these are positions. 29,000 positions that pay $25,000 or more that don't require a college degree.
Give me some examples.
So examples.
What kind of jobs are these?
So the bulk of them are administrative assistant jobs. So, the front desk person at the radio station or at the doctor's office. There are a lot of those kinds of jobs out there. The second, and there are about 10,000 of those. The next largest group of jobs that are these that pay $25,000 or more, don't require a college degree, are in the healthcare arena. So that would be the first job in a career ladder in nursing as a certified nurse assistant. Those kinds of jobs. But there are jobs as bus drivers, as HVAC mechanics, as electricians. There are quite a few positions that do pay a decent wage that don't require a college degree, but they do require some kind of additional training to kind of, quote, prove your value to an employer.
But there are 25,000 of them, but they are... How many of them are filled?
Right. So that's a constantly variable number. So, but if you assume that 10% are open at any time, that's 2,500 jobs right there. And with attrition and whatnot, I don't think it's unreasonable to believe that there are, you know, rolling jobs. And just to give an example, I work very closely with the University of Virginia Hospital. The first rung on a career ladder in nursing is this certified nurse assistant position. Last year, the University of Virginia had close to 200 certified nurse assistant jobs that they could not fill. So that's a great place to start.
Again, our guest today, Ridge Schuyler, the director, founder, bottle washer, and all-around guru guy at Charlottesville Works Initiative. The publisher of the Orange Dot Project from 2011 and again in 2015?
The Charlottesville Works Initiative is actually a project or an initiative of this very poorly named entity that was created by the Chamber of Commerce in 1979. The Chamber of Commerce started an organization in 1979 called the Greater Charlottesville Area Development Corporation with a mission to reduce unemployment and underemployment and eliminate poverty. This was our local Chamber of Commerce did that. And so that Greater Charlottesville Area Development Corporation is my parent organization, and that's the organization for whom I work, and that's who published the Orange Dot Project report and is the host for the Charlottesville Works Initiative.
Now, the Orange Dot Project got its name by identifying Charlottesville neighborhoods. And if you were green, then you were above the median needed income for non-subsidy requirements to have for your family. And if you were orange, you got an orange dot on the neighborhood that showed that was a fairly poor neighborhood, and they were having poverty and unemployment issues.
That is correct. And that the name actually came from a map that was generated for me by a colleague that I used to work at the Nature Conservancy. And when I left there as a parting gift, the map maker there made me a demographic map of the entire 5th Congressional District, stretching from Greene County all the way down to the North Carolina line, Danville and Martinsville. And he color-coded counties based on their income. And as you said, green were counties were neighborhoods of high income, and dark orange were neighborhoods of low income. And if you looked at the entire map of the 5th Congressional District, you saw a lot of orange down in Danville and Martinsville where people are struggling. But there were also this big orange dot, which was the city of Charlottesville and some of the neighborhoods in there. And that's where the project got its name. And I talked to activists and supporters of struggling people in Charlottesville way back when I was working for Congressman Perriello when I had this map. And we kind of, as a shorthand, kept talking, what are we going to do about this orange dot? How are we going to move people up from a position of struggle into making enough money where that isn't the primary concern in their lives?
One of the phrases that you see repeatedly in the report is real jobs for real people. I'm curious if you can define real job and then define real person, real
right.
people.
So it's interesting. Way back when I was starting the project, I was talking to somebody who lived in one of these neighborhoods, and I was talking about what I was thinking about doing to try to address this situation. And he said, I don't really care what you do as long as it's for real. And so that's how real jobs and real people got in there. I wanted to be for real. And what I meant by that was, for a long time, for 40 years, we have been training people for jobs, what I would say jobs in the abstract, types of jobs, like in the healthcare sector. We're going to train you for a job in the healthcare sector, but with no idea of who's the actual employer at the other end who is actually hiring somebody. We should be positioning people for jobs that actually exist, not jobs that some reports say are likely to exist. So that's why the real jobs part is I wanted to find jobs that actually exist, where there is an employer out there hiring and that are sufficient to pay a wage that would allow people to meet their basic needs. And so a real job, in my view, is a job that actually exists, where there's somebody out there hiring, that pays a decent wage, which, you know, in my work is something that's $25,000 or more. To translate that into an hourly wage, it's about $12.50 an hour. So I focus on jobs that pay $12.50 an hour that don't require a college degree. That's the real jobs. The real people is we often, especially if you're looking at numbers and statistics and census data, actual people get lost in that data. When we see 1,800 families struggling in Charlottesville, it's not 1,800 families, it's individual people. And the question is, we know that there are 1,800 at least families struggling in Charlottesville, but how do you find the actual person? How do you find that person who lives in Friendship Court who wants that job at the University of Virginia Hospital? How do you go and find that person? And if we don't get that specific, we can't solve this problem, because poverty gets addressed one person at a time, and we got to go find that person. And that person is likely to be lost, overlooked, kicked to the curb.
It's I'd like to know how you engage both sides of this, and we that may be a little ahead of where we need to be, and if it is, tell me, because there's an awful lot of there are many steps that need to take place, and there's a lot of information that needs to be given to both sides, whether you're the employee, potential employee, or the employer. But if I'm someone who's been regularly unemployed or underemployed and I'm having trouble supporting my family, I'm curious as to how you convince me that you and your group are here to solve my problem.
Yep.
Because I've probably heard that before.
A thousand times.
I'm, you know, 35-year-old woman with two kids, because that's one of the the bits of information is that with the two kids, you're doing the math for one of them being a toddler.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why that is. Are they more expensive, less expensive?
More expensive.
More expensive.
If they're pre public school age, they're very expensive, because you got to go pay somebody to take care of your children,
right.
Hopefully educate them.
You don't have child care from 8 to
right.
3 or 4 in the afternoon.
Except for after school care.
Yeah. Right. So I'm curious as to how you engage me to convince me that it's not just another public city federal program that, you know, yeah, well, sure, if I fill out all the paperwork, I get part of what you're promising me, but it never works up to the story.
No, and that's, I think that goes right back to real jobs and real people. So it starts with the job. There has to be a real job at the end of whatever we're doing on behalf of people. And if there isn't a real job, if there isn't actually an employer out there who can articulate what they're looking for, then I'm not, you know, pursuing anything. It starts with the job. The job drives the train. But, you know, for 40 years, more than that, as we've, you know, engaged in the, quote, war on poverty, a lot of the efforts to find the people who are struggling have been what I would call a broadcast method. Now, I'm sitting here in a radio station, and I don't want to decry broadcast methods, but really it was we advertise jobs in the paper. We put them up on the website. We say, come to our center and learn about the jobs that are available. But it is a broadcast method. It's not targeted at what Rick Moore's capabilities are. It expects Rick to come find those jobs. It is a broadcast method. It is the same kind of method that was used often for a long time to elect candidates. And you'll see where I'm headed here in a minute. In 2008, and again in 2012, President Obama's campaign realized that they were not going to move their voters through a broadcast method, that no amount of radio advertising, excuse me, or newspaper advertising was going to move their voter to the polls, because their voter often was disconnected and didn't believe in the system. And so what the Obama campaign determined was that they needed people in the neighborhoods who knew the voters and could go to the voter and say, here's why it's important that you elect this candidate. They used a ground game. That same ground game is what I'm building to connect people to job opportunities. Find the people in the neighborhoods who know everybody. Give those people job information and have them think to themselves, now, who do I know among my friends and neighbors who would be good at that job? Now, it starts with the actual job. who's looking for who what employer is looking for work, but we take that job information and we give it to well-connected people in their neighborhoods, and they stop and think, who do I know that would be good at that job? And so we use an intentional method, a targeted, focused method, rather than a broadcast method, to find people who are interested in jobs. And I took this notion, which I, you know, developed because of my work on these prior campaigns, and, you know, my thought was, if we can sell political candidates that way, certainly we could sell jobs, which, you know, frankly, are more important to many people than who's elected president. So I started that idea, and I took that idea to a group in Richmond. The mayor of Richmond has an anti-poverty group, and I was asked to go speak to them. And the Citizens Advisory Committee that I was invited to speak to was made up primarily of public housing residents in Richmond. And I showed up, and I'm older, I was wearing a blazer and a tie, and I start, like I always do, talking about jobs. And I think this audience assumed that I was going to start the kind of almost necessary or typical finger wagging, you know, just get a job. And so I started talking about jobs because, in my view, the job drives the train. And somebody raised their hand in the back and said, but we don't know about the jobs. And I said, you're exactly right. You don't know about the jobs. I said, stop and think for a minute about the person in your neighborhood, in your community, who knows everybody. And he started to smile. And I saw smiles across the room as people started thinking about that person in their neighborhood who knew everybody's business. And I said, what if that person knew about the jobs? He fell back in his chair and he said, then it would be a miracle. I'm like, we can do that. We can take job information and give it to that person in the neighborhood who knows everybody. We just have to be intentional about it. We have to be thoughtful about it. We have to move from a broadcast approach to this more intentional ground game approach in order to find that 35-year-old mom that you mentioned who has been left behind her whole life, who is working full-time at some minimum wage job, but who could do so much better than that. Somebody needs to know her and know enough about her to say, you know what? You are such a quality caregiver. You would be a great nurse. And here's the way to do it. Are you interested? And if they say yes, then we say, great, we're on our way.
Amazing. 11:22 here on the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Our guest, Ridge Schuyler from the Charlottesville Works Initiative, as we're talking about poverty, chronic unemployment, and the alternative method that's being made to help solve this problem.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, heating oil and propane for your home or business, and the award-winning Markets of Tiger Fuel, with 6 area locations.
And it's a beautiful day outside, 55, or certainly in the 50-degree range, wherever you are. Here in the Charlottesville, Albemarle, local Central Virginia area. Enjoy the day. And start by enjoying it by finishing up the last 40 minutes on the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. By the way, while we're talking about subsidies and what's important for everyone, I want to tell you that next week, Sean McCord will be here for me. He's going to be interviewing the newly selected mayor of Charlottesville. So this interview might sort of carry over into that. So Sean McCord will be here next Sunday talking with Mike Singler. All right, so back with our guest today, though, Ridge Schuyler. We're talking about how the Orange Dot Project has led to the Charlottesville Works Initiative and have moved from the broadcast format to something that sort of copies the 2008, or what has become the current method of political vote getting. But when you talk about the numbers that are out there, I think this came from the most recent project. By the way, where can people go to find this, the most recent report?
So they would go to the website for the Seaville Chamber, seavillechamber.com. And I'm the Charlottesville Works Initiative is one of the tabs you can click on there at the SevilleChamber.com.
Okay. And this report came out in September of 2015?
Yes, it did.
Okay. 18% of the families cannot afford food, shelter, clothing, utilities, childcare, transportation. Nearly half the children born into no-income, low-income families remain there.
Yep.
You're talking about how a single parent with two kids needs about $35,000 to live without subsidy. because it's not just the food, shelter, clothing, but for the job, there's also the utilities of living there. There's the transportation to get there and childcare. Is it greater difficulty to live in Charlottesville or to live in Albemarle? Because the original report was just Charlottesville, and now you've gone to include Albemarle County as well.
So in terms of cost of living, based on my research, you know, they are roughly equivalent until you get out, you know, in a more rural area where a car is absolutely critical. In Charlottesville and the urban ring of Albemarle County, it is at least theoretical that you could, you know, take a bus where you need to go to get to work. There are challenges to that if you've got childcare as well. But if you're out in rural Albemarle, then you've got, you know, a higher cost of transportation than I calculated. But it is roughly the same. It's a little bit more expensive. Rent in Albemarle is a little bit more expensive on average than in Charlottesville, but it's still, you know, hovering around $1,000 a month for a two-bedroom apartment.
I'm looking for the copies that I printed. It shows that in Albemarle, the more orange, the deeper the orange. So those with the lower income are in the southern part of the county, down near Scottsville or 20 South, for those of you who know the area. There's also a little bit of orange up in the northwest part of the county. I guess that's up in Dyke, above Earliesville anyway. And then in the northeast part of the county. So, you know, one of the early questions is always, why don't you move? Why not move? Charlottesville, Albemarle is a very expensive place to live.
Right. You know, people tend to, you know, live where their families are. That would be the number one reason. I mean, we don't want to, you know, say, well, sorry, you know, it's expensive here, so you should go live somewhere else and leave your family and friends. You know, often in a community where the economy has collapsed, there isn't any choice. In Charlottesville and Albemarle, there is a choice. We do have the jobs. I mean, you know, when I was working for Congressman Perriello, you know, we represented communities where the economy had absolutely collapsed. Martinsville and Danville, you know, being the, you know, kind of the poster children for that, where the textile and furniture economies had collapsed. And in Martinsville, they would have killed for just one of the anchor institutions, I'll call them that we have in Charlottesville. An anchor institution is a major employer who's probably not going anywhere. Martinsville, in economic turmoil, lost its community hospital, for example. Here we have two community hospitals. We have defense contractors. We have a defense installation. We have the regional hub of a nationwide insurance company at State Farm. We have the employers. There isn't a reason for people to have to move. What we ought to do is move people into the jobs that we have. We have employers that are desperate for workers. We have people who are desperate for work. What we have to do is create an intentional pathway between them. And I would rather create that intentional pathway between that job seeker in that job rather than creating an intentional pathway out of our community. These are people with great potential. They want to work. They want to work hard. We just have to create an intentional system of connecting them to those opportunities that we have here. And so I would want to, you know, fully explore that before I said to people, you ought to just move.
What is the Charlottesville Works Initiative thoughts on raising the minimum wage, whether that's a federal rate, regional, a local?
I mean, I think as a practical matter, I don't know if the Charlottesville Works Initiative has a position on that. I have my own personal view, which is that, you know, a uniform increase in the minimum wage is, you know, if you're going to do it, I think you need to do it nationwide. Otherwise, businesses have an incentive to move and jobs just shift around. You know, my attitude is I'm taking the world as it is rather than the world as I would like it to be, at least locally. And there are jobs that pay more than the minimum wage that are available for people. And so rather than fighting a fight up in Washington, which looks like at least for the near term is not likely to be won, I would rather spend my emotional and time, energy focused on connecting people to the jobs that we already have in our region that pay more than the minimum wage. I think a minimum wage job like a job at a fast food is a great starter job. And, you know, kids out of high school, that may be a great first step to understand what the workplace requires and whatnot. It is not a great job for a mom who's trying to raise her children. And what we need to do is find those jobs that are right for that mom trying to raise her children and get her into those jobs. And because they exist and because we know how to do it, we ought to be setting ourselves to doing it.
You talked about what it took for the employee and sort of how you approached them and said, this is what I need from you. This is what I'm offering you. How do you go to the employer?
Right. So, interestingly, I mean, I think of this in terms of, you know, we're all connected to each other through, you know, our human relationships. And I think of those relationships in terms of kind of three different ways. We have an employer network, a network of relationships among employers, often fostered by the Chamber of Commerce, but also by offices of economic development. There are people in our community who make it their business every day to be talking to employers and finding out what those employers need. What kind of, you know, what does it take for you to stay and grow here in Charlottesville, Albemarle? You know, what kind of issues are you having? And those existing employer networks are already unearthing the jobs that are available that would be the kind that we're talking about. That employer network needs to be connected to the job seeker network. The job seeker network is really the people who are on the front lines with folks who struggle. And those networks exist. They're harder to find. They're not formalized like a chamber of commerce, but it's that it's the woman who works, you know, in the vestry of the church. It's the person who's the captain of the soccer team that has a lot of immigrants who play on the soccer team. There are those social networks that exist, and that's what I would call the job seeker network. And then lastly, we are very fortunate in our region to have a lot of service providers, trainers, child care providers, transportation providers. That's the service provider network. There are three networks bound through human relationships, but they don't necessarily connect with each other. The employer network doesn't know how to connect with that job seeker network. That service network may not know how to connect with that job seeker who's trying to get to that job at the hospital. And so what I'm trying to do is align those three networks. And on the employer side, you know, because I'm affiliate of the Chamber of Commerce, I go to Chamber of Commerce board meetings and I hear employers who say, we are desperate for finding skilled workers. We really, you know, would love somebody's help in finding skilled workers. And that knowledge is there. Now, it isn't always actionable information. So, you know, somebody may say, I got this great job out in Gordonsville working at a big manufacturing facility, but I need more information than that to know who would be a good fit for that job. So it does take a little bit more digging to say to that employer, what exactly are you looking for? What is the job exactly? What does it entail? What kind of credentials does somebody need to get that? What are the hours? What are the wages? So that I can take that information, give it to my people who are well connected in the neighborhood so they can think who would be good at that job. So I say that one of the things that we need to do is we know who the employers are. What we need to do is collect from them what I call actionable intelligence about the jobs that are available. What are the wages? What are the hours? What kind of criminal background check do you require? What kind of credentials do we need so that our peer network, our network of job seekers can think, now who would be good at that job? So I think as it turns out over the year that I've had a pilot out there, that identifying the jobs is not nearly as difficult as identifying the job seeker, because the job seeker is obviously spread out. There's not a formalized system. We don't have an association of job seekers that you can just turn to that have a board meeting and then you just say, hey, there's this job out there. You have to go and find them. Find the people who want those jobs. And that requires more work than we have, than has historically been put into the effort.
11:34 on the Wake Up Call. The guest today, Ridge Schuyler, Charlottesville Works Initiative. We're talking about poverty, chronic unemployment, and helping those folks and starting a diverse system to make this happen. Ridge, you used the word skills. And how do you define or help someone who needs a skill? If the employer says, this is what I need. I need someone who can, the job requires someone to do basic math because you can't pull out your calculator every time you need to subtract you know, 9 from 45.
You know, I didn't know there was going to be a quiz.
Exactly. And I'm like, wait a minute.
Pulling out my calculator.
What number can I give you back? 36, by the way. And I did not use my phone. But you get the information from the employer. What do you do for the employee?
Right.
And then are there times when you tell the employer, sorry, we can't help you because the job only pays $8 an hour, or because it's only a part-time job and therefore doesn't, in your mind or Charlotte's Works Initiative mind, help solve the problem of the underemployment issue? Right.
So the answer to your second question is, yes, there are times that employers have come to me and said, can you help me find somebody for a job? And the wage is just too low for it to be worth, you know, the effort to find the person and get them positioned. So yes, I have turned down employers to say, look, you know, that wage just doesn't quite meet what we're trying to go. And, you know, so I have said to employers, sorry, I'm not the right one to help you. With regard to the skills, you know, again, we are very fortunate in our community. We have an excellent community college that it does provide skills, especially when that skill is kind of required. And I'll tell you what, you know, to drive a bus for Charlottesville Area Transit, you need a commercial driver's license. To work on the first rung of a career ladder in nursing, you need to be a certified nurse assistant. Those are state-required certifications that people can get that end up making you valuable, and it's understandable why. Not everybody has a CDL, commercial driver's license. Not everybody has a certified nurse assistant license. So the pool of applicants is narrowed by that requirement to have that skill. That skill is teachable. It's teachable in a short amount of time. So that really is a great place to go look for jobs that pay a decent wage that you can move people into in fairly short order. And, you know, so I'll, you know, the example that I will give you is, as I mentioned earlier on, UVA Hospital had a need for certified nurse assistants. I began talking to them, and they said, can you help us find people to fill those jobs? I said, absolutely. One of the first people that I met to get into our training program was a mother with two kids living in a homeless shelter in Charlottesville. She really wanted to be a nurse. She was a private duty sitter, not making very much money. And we got her trained both what we call soft skills training, which is that kind of, you know, how do you maintain punctuality and good communication skills, and how do you handle adversity in the workplace, that kind of soft stuff that is essential really for working in any kind of place of business. We taught soft skills and the certified nurse assistant licensing all within a span of 12 weeks. So within 12 weeks, she moved from being somebody making $8 an hour to somebody making close to $30,000 a year. And what kept her on the path, was it grueling for her? Absolutely. She was working, taking care of her kids, and going to training at the same time. That is not an easy task. And we supported her every step of the way. What drove her, what gave her momentum, was the fact that there was a known job, a known employer at the other end. That 12 weeks wasn't going to be just you finish it and then you kind of wonder what happens next. There was somebody at the other end waiting to interview her. Now, she wasn't guaranteed a job there at the University of Virginia Hospital, but she knew there was an availability, and they knew she was coming. And that made all the difference.
When you're talking about these jobs, are you, whether it's discussing this with me now or whether it's discussing this with potential, with the folks who are underemployed or unemployed, are we talking about groups of jobs? Nurses with the university, people who need their CDL license because it's not just bus drivers, but I think if you pay any attention to the news, truck drivers are needed everywhere, as opposed to a business that needs one or two positions and can't wait 12 weeks for this person to become available and ready.
Right. So that is a very excellent question. And we have, at the Charlottesville Works Initiative and with our partners at the City of Charlottesville who run a very similar training approach called the Growing Opportunities Programs, both of our approaches are job-driven. They've got to have the job at the end before you find the people and start training them. But sometimes we train in groups, Like my folks who are going to become certified nurse assistants at the University of Virginia Hospital or elsewhere, it's groups of 10 because we know there are those number of jobs available out there. But I've also done it the other way where we have brought in a group of 10. We train generally 10 to 12 people at a time. We brought in 10 or 12 people who are all going to disparate jobs. One person was going to be an administrative assistant. One person was going to do high-end retail. One person was going to go into facilities maintenance. What we gave them in that case was the soft skills training so that we could say to an employer, this person is ready for your job. They've been hand-selected. Somebody who knows them thought they'd be good at it. They thought to themselves, I want to do that. We gave them soft skills training and then turned around and said to the employer, "Here's that person that you were looking for." That soft skills training, not the technical training, but the soft skills training, is only about 3.5 weeks. And most employers expect to take about a month to hire somebody, especially if the jobs pay a decent wage. If you're talking about minimum wage jobs, those jobs churn all the time and somebody loses their job and the next day there's somebody to fill it. But I'm not after those jobs. The employers that I'm working with are willing to wait, and they are willing to wait longer if a technical certification is required. So they know that you can't just create a certified nurse assistant, and they're willing to wait for those certified nurse assistants to be trained. So the more training that is required, the more patience the employer has to wait for somebody to fill that job because it requires some kind of specialty.
How about the patience for the employee?
So,
because I would think that there's a lot. I mean, you specifically mentioned the one woman who was trying to run her family, train, and all the other, live a daily life and then toss in the extra training for, going to school for the job. How do you keep someone? Is there any sort of pat on the back? Let's go. You can do it kind of thing.
Oh, absolutely. So there are two things that really help maintain the momentum through this grueling, period. One is the knowledge that there is an employer at the other end and that the pathway is very, very clear. I know that when I take this state exam, I will be within days of fulfilling the requirements to apply at the University of Virginia Hospital. The fact that the job is known, that the pathway is clear, helps maintain the momentum. But during that time, as life intrudes and troubles come up at school or whatnot, either I or the peer that brought them in is there to give them emotional support, to help them along that pathway so they don't just quit in the middle of it when the opportunity is right there for them to grab.
It's 11:42 here on the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. We're talking about poverty. We're talking about chronic unemployment and underemployment with Rich Schuyler from the Charlottesville Works Initiative, an outgrowth of the Orange Dot Project. You can go to
SeavilleChamber.com.
SeavilleChamber.com and read both the project and a little more about it and the September 2015 latest report. It's exciting to read, really, because you're not only getting some information that was probably being overlooked by many of us, even though we're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Sometimes we seem to focus on one or two topics that may be progressive. This one is very important to us.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, heating oil and propane for your home or business, and the award-winning Markets of Tiger Fuel with 6 area locations.
All right, and here we are back with Ridge Schuyler on a beautiful Sunday for January, even though for those of us who like a little snow, I'm happy to not have it today. So, Ridge, we were talking about you've done the pilot program. Is that the best word for it? You've
yes.
done one setup with
one year,
with, one
of,
year?
Of work with actual, with as we going back to dating, with real jobs and real people. The lead up to the pilot was doing a lot of research about what do other communities do, what have we done nationwide, what have we learned, and taking all of that and then saying to actual people, are you willing to come along on this pilot with us, knowing that we are, feeling our way through it. And the first group of 10 were I told them that they were they were kind of my guinea pigs, and I should bring a head of lettuce to every training session because they were willing to go along for the ride. And as we worked through it together, it became clear why they call these things pilots, because you're flying a plane and building it at the same time, and it can get a little bit rocky. But we made it through, and that was my first group of 10, and we've had subsequent groups of 10 over the course of the last year to test and perfect this approach to see if it actually worked.
Yeah, you look at the pretty little pictures, multicolor in the report. So you've had 39 people enrolled.
Correct.
21 still in training.
Right.
17 have completed, and one who decided wasn't going to work for them.
Correct.
And I guess I don't.
Got their own job that paid an okay wage. She had just had a child, and she decided that okay wage was where she wanted to go for right now. So that's what she did.
Okay. So 17 people have completed the program. Did they all find the jobs that they were originally led to? The carrot, that's where the carrot was. Did they all get to go to that carrot?
Right. So the short answer is no. In our first group of 10, six of them were there because there was a specific job at the end that they were aimed for. But four of them were there because this peer network, this thing that I was building based on the Obama ground game, the peer network brought those folks in because they knew them to be struggling. But they weren't after one of the jobs that I had available. And I thought, well, maybe that will work. It's a pilot. Let's try it. So the six who were after jobs that we had in the can got the jobs they were after. The four who were there just because somebody saw them as people who needed more income, we struggled a little bit more with those four. They ultimately landed quality jobs, but not ones that they were in the program to get. And it did kind of reinforce my idea that it really does need to be job-driven, that people need to know why they're in training, what job is waiting for them at the end. Otherwise, they finish the training and then there is floundering because they're not something in particular in mind.
And step out of these numbers for a moment.
Yep.
Who makes up the peer network? I have the vision of somebody that you go to church with every week.
Mm-hmm.
That's the vision that I have.
Yep.
And maybe that's inappropriate.
No,
but that's my vision. Is it the person who sees you in church and says, why weren't you here last week?
Yes.
Or how's that job hunt going?
Yes.
So maybe not the minister, but the deacon.
Exactly. As we work on building this out together, the first two peers that I worked with for purposes of the pilot, as I started to go out and find peers, well-connected people in their neighborhoods, the same kind of person that would have been a neighborhood team leader under the Obama's campaign, the well-connected person who knew the voters and could talk to them about the president, as I went out to find those people, those well-connected people, and it's interesting that it turned out this way, they found me. They said, I heard through the community what you were doing, and I want to be a part of it. And that's how I found my first two peers. And one of them runs a faith-based organization in one of our struggling neighborhoods in Charlottesville at Prospect Avenue. And the other was a woman who lived in Friendship Court as a single mom for 26 years and is now a teaching assistant at a local elementary school. Both of them came to me and said, I see what you're doing, and I believe in it, and I want to be a part of it. And so those were my first two peers. But peers are really anybody who works on or who has reason to be on the front lines with people who struggle. So, for example, there's a young man who lives in Charlottesville who is a formerly incarcerated individual. He's working now. But when people get out of prison or jail, a lot of them will turn to him and say, hey, can you help me find a job? And up until now, his answer has been, I would love to, but I don't know how to find you a job. Now I can give him the tools to find the job. I can provide him the job information so that he has a running list of available jobs. When somebody says, I want that job, he can think through the list that he has and think, you know what, you'd be really good at this job as a bus driver or as an HVAC mechanic. But he'll know if that job has some kind of barrier crime restriction, he's not going to go and say you should try out for this job that he knows that the person ultimately cannot get. So you are exactly right. When you envision the person in the church, the captain of the soccer team, the woman who is the guidance counselor at the high school who works with kids who are not going to college, the woman at the Department of Social Services who is charged with trying to find people jobs, they're all the peer network. They are on the front lines with the people who struggle. They know who they are. They know who would be a good fit for the kind of jobs that we have available, and they are exactly who I have in mind.
Ridge Schuyler here talking about poverty and chronic unemployment. Ridge representing the Charlottesville Works Initiative. So back to the numbers. The first year, 39 people taking the classes, learning the trades, et cetera. You've got 17 who've completed, 12 of them making the $25,000 and above that you wanted.
Right. And that was a snapshot from the summer, and I apologize I didn't bring in the more recent data, but it has been tracking that almost exactly. We're about, as these numbers show, 88% of the people who complete have gotten jobs, and 80% of those jobs pay $25,000 or more. Important for my purposes is that 38% of the people that we've helped are single moms, because they're the most likely to be isolated and might and most likely to be stuck in some low-wage job without the ability to find their way out.
You've got 21 still training. How close are they to being finished?
Well, some of those have finished now. Some of those were in the certified
from
nurses.
From the September report.
Yep.
That's right, reports in September.
So, they have gone on to become certified nurse assistants at the University of Virginia Hospital or drivers for Charlottesville Area Transit or the school system bus program. So, we are tracking along with those numbers. And, what has been proven to be kind of one of the most important attributes is the fact that there is an actual job at the end, and that's what keeps people moving.
So am I right to assume that this is a city-funded program, city-county-funded program?
You are not right to assume that.
Okay.
It has been privately funded through philanthropy for the most part. So, local philanthropists who see this as a potential solution to the problem of poverty and underemployment, companies that see this as a very important mechanism to help them find workers, really kind of a huge array of private philanthropy funds my work.
Do you currently, or do you expect that someone like, or an organization like, University of Virginia through the hospital say, we're going to give you some money because this is the way that we're finding more CNAs than more regularly? We envision this to be a regular production of CNAs than we do any other way.
Right. So that has already happened. So the University of Virginia has helped fund my efforts to find these CNAs and to pay for their training. So it's already happening. Employers are seeing this as a way of filling a need that they have. I mean, in the beauty of this is that it does work for everyone. We have, as I said before, employers like the University of Virginia Hospital desperate to find quality caregivers. We have people in our communities who are quality caregivers, but they don't have the knowledge or the credentials to get the jobs that the university has. So we are building that intentional pipeline, and the University of Virginia has been right there with me doing it.
Other than pay, mm-hmm. again, the goal being a minimum of $25,000, mm-hmm. are there any other requirements? Are you looking for, must there be benefits like health care or et cetera?
So I have not turned away a $25,000 a year job because it doesn't come with benefits.
Okay.
It's obviously a lot better, and that's really up to the individual. I send the information out to the peer network saying, here's a $25,000 a year job. It does not have benefits. And if the job seeker says, I can't take a job without benefits, then they pass on that job. So, part of this is increasing information flow, and I don't want to be, too prescriptive in the information that I'm sending out, but I am I do have a bottom line that is more or less absolute, which is that $25,000 a year, because it just is too tough if you're making less than that.
At what point do you envision another Orange Dot project, or is there another project that will allow you to see what, if any, influence the Works Initiative has had on these families.
Right. So, you know, our next step is to, now that we've run the pilot and seen some success, and like I say, there's a really, I would call it a sister program operating in the city called the Growing Opportunities Program that's operated out of their Office of Economic Development, and we work very, very closely together. They've moved a few more people than I have, but it's the same ideas. Find the people, put the job at the end. Our next challenge is scaling. How do we reach more people? I mean, it's great that I've reached 40 people and the city, I think, has reached 60 people. That's 100. But if you look at the overall numbers of Charlottesville Albemarle, it's 5,661 families that are struggling. So 100 is great. It is not nearly what is needed to move the number of people we're talking about. So the next issue is one of scale. And this next year, we'll spend expanding the scale. As we expand the scale, how do we find more peers? How do we touch more job seekers? How do we enlist more employers into this effort? One of the things we always want to keep our eye on is it actually working? Or is this just a bunch of talk? And the way we determine whether it's working, it's to my mind, it is one thing and one thing only. Are people's wages where they need to be and are they moving up? And other than that, it doesn't matter how many people I've enrolled. It doesn't matter how many people I've trained. What matters is how many are earning $25,000 or more, and hopefully their income is moving up over time. And that really is the acid test. And that's what holds us accountable, is being able to track that kind of information.
11:55, just a few minutes left on the Sunday morning wake-up call with our guest, Ridge Schuyler from the Charlottesville Works Initiative. Follow-up question to that is, do you check back the people who, whether it's the University of Virginia with the CNAs or Charlottesville, with whatever the job, if they're only being paid $25,000 at the beginning, and you know from your numbers that the mother or the single parent with two kids needs $35,000, are you checking back to see that the business is meeting their promise of this being an entry-level job with growth?
Right. So, I mean, we've been at it for a year, and we are in constant contact with all of our participants. I mean, it's part of the beauty is it is a whole system built on human relationships. So I get texts from my job seekers all the time, you know, can you help me find the next job up? So I do have constant feedback about where they are income-wise, and for the most part, people's incomes are going up. What we would like over time is to be able to plot that income without having them report back to us by collecting that wage data over time. But, like I said, that first successful CNA applicant, because she works nights and weekends, because that's what she wanted, because she wanted to be home during the week with her kids, she's making roughly $30,000 a year now.
Is there any assistance offered to these folks once they start to get this kind of pay? Any financial aid? Not financial aid. Financial
literacy training.
Yeah,
financial literacy.
To keep your budget, because when you get that first paycheck and you're like, "Holy cow! Look at this! I can buy new shoes. I can go get the other car that I." But just hey. Don't be spending all that money at one time, because it still doesn't meet the budget that we'd like you to follow.
Yes. So there is, fortunately, in the city of Charlottesville and the surrounding region, there are four different entities that provide that financial literacy training, and we introduce our people to that. But it is critical. Once you're earning that money, you got to think about taxes, and you got to think about the debt you may have accrued when you're making that minimum wage job. So we do have financial literacy that comes after you get that job. And in fact, one of my job seekers who's working at the University of Virginia Hospital wants to move it. She's living with her mom. They used to live in a homeless shelter. Now they're living in a market rate apartment in Charlottesville, but they're living together, with income together. She now wants to move out on her own, and we're now talking about what can she afford on the income that she makes at the hospital. What can she afford, and how far out will she need to live in order to make that income, meet her desire to have a one-bedroom apartment and be on her own? But it is all a part of the same equation. What do you do with the money once you get it?
Just a minute and a half left with Ridge Schuyler. How do people get in touch with you? People, of course, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville has folks listening, whether they need to get in touch with you, whether they want to be the peer in the neighborhood. What's the contact?
The best way really is to email me. And I don't know if you all can post an email, but I can give it to you right now if that would be helpful.
If you give it to us, we'll cvillepodcast.com. We'll include that in the podcast information, and then we'll take care of it and spread the word from there.
Great.
So that is the best way. And people can also, I guess, Google Charlottesville Works Initiative
Correct.
That as well.
You can get to me through the Chamber of Commerce.
So goals for 2016, you talk about expanding on a scale basis, but if we invite you back next year, I want to know, what can you say is like, oh yes, goals were met.
Right. So my plan is to, over the next year, enlist 10 more peers. Those are the people who know the job seekers. So enlist and train 10 more peers so we can expand the peer network and move, I think my number is 75 more people into decent paying jobs as part of a second year of this pilot.
All right, Ridge, thank you so much. Good luck.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And I'm sure Jeff Leonard and WPVC will support you and what you do at Charlottesville Works.
They already have.
So Ridge Schuyler, Charlottesville Works Initiative. You can check out the podcast, cvillepodcast.org. Thank you so much. Next week, again, Sean McCord will be here interviewing the newly selected mayor of Charlottesville. Take care.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.